from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Do you like where you work? Not the company, the workspace. Is it comfortable? Lavish? Gritty? Does it feel like a place where you can do your best work? Silicon Valley may be the 21st century version of a factory town with open workspaces, lush corporate campuses, and tons of perks. Facebook just moved to new digs, and Apple plans to bring its scattered staff together under one completely circular roof. How much does where you work affect how you work? New insights on workplace design, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. I have a cubicle, always have, and somehow I've managed to do pretty good work under the harsh fluorescent lighting of one newsroom after another. But really, people, isn't there more to life than the cubicle? These days, if you want to escape the workplace as usual, the tech sector seems to be the place to be. Silicon Valley in particular has declared war on the cubicle with funky office spaces, open floor plans, and hallways wide enough to skateboard down when you need to unwind. And maybe that actually helps people be more productive. Maybe. Let's explore the workplace of the future in this hour of Forum and see what it might mean for those of us who work in more traditional settings. Joining us this hour are Allison Arieff, design and architecture writer for The New York Times. She has the latest on how new companies are structuring their new workplaces. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Also, Professor Franklin Becker teaches in the Department of Design and Environmental Analysis at Cornell University. He has more perspective on workplaces nationally and over time, and he joins us by phone. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
And later on this hour, we'll speak to Jeremy Nooner of Next Space, one of several organizations that offers companies a new way to share workspace. We'd like to share our space with you. Where do you work? What about your workspace is and is not working for you? Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email your questions and thoughts to forum at kqed.org. Post them to our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can hit us up on our Facebook page. So, Allison.
Yes.
I know I'm not the only one who hates my cubicle. Right. And there's something, I don't hate my job, just for the record, so if anyone from the newsroom is listening, I don't hate the job. But the cubicle seems to be that quintessential Dilbert-esque representation of the way it's always been and the way it's always going to be for work. Facebook's new offices have made a lot of headlines, not only because of where they are and the concerns over traffic density and so on, but just the fact that it's Facebook. And everyone kind of presumes, gosh, to be inside Facebook must be the coolest place in the world to work. What's that workplace like as far as we know?
Well, it's sort of been top secret what exactly that workplace is at Facebook, but I can speculate to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be a lot of cubicles. I recently helped put together a report with Spur, where I edit their magazine, The Urbanist. Spur is the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association here in San Francisco. And among the projects we were working on was the future of the corporate campus. And an interesting thing to note about Facebook is that they took over the Sun Microsystems space. And Sun Microsystems had 3,400 employees in that space, and Facebook will have 6,600 employees.
Wow.
In the same space.
And they're not modifying the buildings. They're just packing more people in?
The interiors will be modified radically. And whereas an employee may have had from 350 to 500 square feet for themselves, say, 10, 20 years ago, now that's moving down to 250 to 150 per person and even less. But I think what we'll see most significantly at Facebook, and again, I'm speculating, is that increasingly, work is done collaboratively. So the argument is that you don't even need a cubicle. You might not even need your own desk because you're constantly working in teams. And therefore, you'll probably just have
a couch on the floor.
You can bring your laptop on a desk that's on wheels. You can work on a chair in the corner. Or you can work in the dining hall. Or you can work outside in the yard. The era of sort of having a little cubicle where you could be monitored and watched and sort of contained is pretty much over. For now, I think these trends definitely come and go.
But I kind of wonder what it does to the way that you conceive of work. I mean, when I'm at at least here at KQED, I have a cubicle where I work, and then I go down the hall to about, I guess it's 150 feet down the length of the building to the news booth, which is where I do the newscast. So I have a physical space that I associate with prepping newscasts, and I have a physical space that I associate with doing newscasts. From KQED News, I'm Joshua Johnson. And when I'm not in either of those physical spaces, I'm not really at work. I mean, unless like a fire breaks out and I got to go run to it. Right. I wonder what it does to work when your workplace is not the only place you work. When you can be at a cubicle or be in the dining hall or be on like some one of those little fitness balls that you sit on at the gym and sitting at a desk. Psychologically, you know, if you're at Facebook, you're pretty much working wherever you are in the building, whether you're at your cube or not.
Right. Well, I think it says a lot about the live-work balance that we're all talking about. Because I think kind of the little secret about all of this is that the workplace is being made so flexible and there are so many places offered for you to work and be. And then the ultimate idea is that you're going to be at work all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the live-work balance is thus achieved because work might be more fun. The office might be nicer to look at. At Google, there's food every 5 feet. There are snacks on shelves. There's frozen yogurt machines in the hallways. So instead of having a life at home and then a life at work, you really, in a lot of these workplaces, are having your life. You could have breakfast, lunch, dinner, after-dinner drinks, et cetera, and not actually leave the building.
Or having no life, maybe.
Or having no life at all.
Your life is on Facebook and at Facebook if you work there, maybe.
Right. So there is a little bit of a dark side to all of these changes as well.
It's not just the space that employees have, though I believe it's the placement of the architecture and kind of the openness and green space. You know, if they know you're going to be working, you know, 9,000 hours a week, they want you to be working at least more consciously. They want to design the space so that you're working in a place where you're comfortable, that feels bright and airy and makes you feel like, you know, like you want to be there.
Absolutely. And that's huge. In the Beyond the Cubicle story I wrote for the New York Times a few months back, I started off talking about this documentary called The Cubicle, which I would recommend. And the filmmaker did a series of interviews with people in cubicles that just felt ever smaller and more contained, like someone who was in between two air shafts, for example. And, you know, clearly these people didn't have natural light and parks to go to. And but it's clear that there's a million health benefits to designing spaces this way, too, especially one, say, Google, again, where they have bikes on campus and you can get from one destination to the other. Facebook may be doubling the number of people in its office space, but they're not increasing the number of parking spaces. So they'll be incentivizing people for not driving and taking transit and carpooling and you know, facilitating ways for them to get exercise as well.
We're going to go to the phones in just 1 second, but I want to bring in Professor Frank Becker from Cornell University. Professor, in some ways, this sounds kind of cool. In other ways, this does not sound cool at all. I do not like the idea of having less office space with more people being forced to collaborate in different ways. It's got to be a little bit interesting for you to observe the change in how people work, the way people work, where people work, whether they have to be in a physical space or not. What do you make of all the changes in the place of the workplace?
Well, first I should say I should give you my condolences for having to work in a Dilbert cube.
I'm working in a Dilbert cube at a cool public radio station, so do not cry for me. But thank you.
Well, I think it's fascinating what we're talking about. And, I mean, for me, in part, the starting point, which is the interesting numbers, whatever, 3,500 to 6,600, I don't think that should be lost, which is that with a new design that's justified in lots of ways, as was just said, teamwork, communication, collaboration, light, the fact is that you're getting twice the number of people in the same space, and that saves you money. And I don't think that that's a minor issue. I mean, one of the things to realize is the reasons cubicles became so popular in the late 50s, early 60s in this country was that you could save a lot of money. If you think about it, if I tried to put you into a, say, 8 foot by 8 foot or even 6 foot by 8 foot office, what would you call that? I think you'd call it a prison cell.
Well, yeah, know? that would depending on the company, it's definitely like a prison cell. Yeah,
right. It wouldn't work. But if I put you in that in an open plan, I can make that work. So the first thing to understand is that there's in the research we've done over 20 years looking at all these kinds of things and the evolution of them. One of the interesting things is about how things are justified. And what no one talks about, really, is the cost savings and in some sense, than the building savings, the energy savings, by putting more people into less space. I do agree that it has lots of potential benefits, but I should say that in doing research in this specific area for over 20 years, there's very little data that would strongly substantiate the benefits that come from this kind of space, putting whether it's Apple under one roof or the kind of corporate campus that Facebook has, that Nike has, and so on. There's lots of things that it may do, but there's not a lot of data that supports it, which I find very interesting.
So I want to camp on that a little bit more in just a second, but first I want to take a call from San Jose. Please forgive me for the pronunciation of your name, Pooja. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's Pooja.
Pooja. Good morning.
Yeah.
I apologize
Good
about
morning.
Your name. Good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I currently work in a company where everyone has an office.
Everyone?
And, when I everyone.
Wow.
And when I started working there, I thought it was a huge luxury, and I thought it was awesome. And I came from a completely cubicle culture. But I've been there 4 years, and I only see downsides to it now. You know, we are a team of about 7 or 8, and we rarely communicate outside of what is required, you know, for our work. And although I've been there so long, I can honestly say I don't really know any of my teammates very well, and they don't know me outside of work very well. And in my previous companies, you know, we would just stop by and chat, and it also increased productivity in our work because we could constantly exchange ideas. And what happens now is if we work on a project, we're shifted to something called a war room. Everybody involved in a project are shifted to a war room, and that's where we spend probably a year or two, and we don't see the rest of the team.
So you're basically kind of locked away from everyone else in the company to work on a project?
Yeah. I was on a project for 2 years, and I was in a separate building in a separate room with just the people working on the project. And, you know, the lady who sits next to my office, I haven't seen her in 2 years because she's on a project and she's tucked away somewhere else.
You almost sound like, and I want to put this to Professor Becker, this almost sounds like, Professor, what you were talking about as it relates to working in a prison cell. That sounds like a very apt description of what Pooja is describing, Professor.
Well, yes and no. I mean, partly what Pooja is saying is that in our own research, I would say we found the same thing, that people really strongly believe and often prefer a single office, just because they feel like they can control who they interact with. They don't have to worry about how loudly they talk or other people's talking. But if people have had both experiences, which is what Pooja's saying, is that what they find is that they actually miss the opportunities to get to know someone, to understand who they are, what their skills are, what they can help you accomplish, that they may help motivate you because they're being productive. Lots of benefits by being accessible in that kind of way, which is not necessarily being in a cube. From my point of view, we talk about open environments, but in fact, there's lots of different kinds of open environments. A cube is one, and again, our own research shows that it's not particularly successful. Much more successful, I think, is what Allison was describing, which is a more open environment in which people are not separated by high panels. There's lots of places they can choose to work. Some of them may be quite quiet, quite opportunities for confidential conversations are good. They can see each other. Very different kind of open environment than a cube environment. And just to say one thing about the war room, that the good part about that is that, you know, a team can go there, they can get to know each other, they can work together. But there is data from a colleague of mine at MIT which suggests that really productive, innovative teams have people who interact a lot with people who are not part of their team. Uh-huh. Not part of their team. And the reason is simple, is that after a while, when we're in a team environment like that, I know exactly what everybody thinks, how they think, what they're going to say. I could probably give their answer to my question before I've asked it.
Right.
One of the values of that kind of more open environment is you run into people who may essentially come from a different whole mindset and say, why are you doing it that way? Or could you do it this way? Or have you thought about that?
So you just kind of lose out on those chance encounters that make
exactly.
great things happen.
Yeah, and that would be my concern about being in a truly secluded war room in a different building.
Well, Pooja, you have my condolences. I assure you I will not complain about my cubicle ever again. Thank you very much for your call, and I wish you well. Pooja, thank you. Also, I want to go to an email from Michael in San Jose. He writes, quote, "Yes, Dilbert has created the best cartoons lampooning cubicles, but this is a serious topic. For 2 years, I worked in a small cubicle in a windowless building. It was dehumanizing, stifling, unpleasant, miserable. There was no privacy. I will never, if there's anything I can do to avoid it, work in a cubicle again. If employers are smart, then they will not incarcerate their employees in these tiny cells. Michael, you have my condolences." But Professor Becker, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't the guy who invented the cubicle later say he regretted it?
I don't know.
I do know that.
Is that true?
Who was that?
Robert Probst. He said it was the worst thing he had ever done. He completely regretted it. It was completely spun out of control from what it had been originally intended. And okay. Sort of his deathbed words, I think. I'm sorry.
That's a heck of a thing to apologize for on your deathbed.
Well, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but his initial office system was actually quite innovative, but as with everything, they got smaller and smaller for the reasons that the professor spoke of, is that real estate costs a lot of money if you can fit more people in the same space. So what might have been initially a spacious, pleasant place to be in, cubicle or not, got smaller and more prohibitive and less pleasant.
That's absolutely right. And Action Office, which was developed, came from actually a German approach, which is called Bürolandschaft, which was again, the first use of kind of open panel-based systems, but there the panels weren't locked together. Everything was freestanding, so you could move a panel, move a chair, move a desk, and it was much more organic. But when it came to the U.S., it started out, interestingly enough, just like Allison was saying, with Herman Miller and Probst, but for cost reasons, again, and for control reasons, is that they created essentially these interlocking systems so that the individual employee could no longer shift a panel or put their desk in a different orientation.
Right.
And all of a sudden is that this became a very tightly controlled environment with very little choice, and that sort of morphed quickly into the kind of hated Dilbert-like cues, which, as I said, they really serve almost no good purpose.
Right, right. We're speaking to Professor Frank Becker of Cornell University and Allison Arieff of the New York Times. We'd like to hear from you, too. How is your workplace designed? Does it work for you? What would you like if you could rip up your workplace, same company, same purposes, and redesign the place where you work? Or maybe if you don't think you need a place to work. Maybe you could all work just as well remotely from home, in your bathroom, in your bunny slippers, than you work at your office. What would you do to make your workplace a better place to work? Please call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Let's speak to, is it Lisa or Lisa from Mountain View?
It's Liza.
Liza. Liza with an S. Good morning, Liza. How are you?
Liza with a Z.
Oh.
I have worked in lots of different situations, and I'm actually an educator. And I think that your panel's making, at least sounding to me, like you're making one mistake, which is that one size fits all.
Hmm.
I think that all of these different plans are very, very useful, but workers, like students, are not all the same. So the best solution is to have a variety of solutions so that workers can choose. I, for example, am very distractible, so a cube, which is where I can hear other people talk, decreases my work, but I also want to be able to get out of an office space. I need a quiet space, but then I also need to be able to get out and circulate and work in a team. So I would say having the option of having an office or a cube or an open space or working at home is more effective than saying here's the right plan.
Hey Liza, I want to put this to Allison Arieff in just one second, but I want to dig a little deeper into what you're saying because I think you're making an interesting point. You say you work in education. Are you a classroom teacher or an administrator or?
I'm a specialist teacher. I was actually a pioneer in the use of computers in education.
Cool.
So I've watched a lot of people in learning and working in very unfamiliar tasks, because in the early days computers were a completely novel environment, and people had very, very different learning styles,
Now, dealing with special education, I hate to cut you short. I just know we've got a bunch of other calls to grab. Dealing in special education, do you find that certain kinds of students under certain kinds of circumstances clearly benefit from different physical environments to work in? Do you need to put certain kinds of kids in desks on their own? Do you need to put certain kind of kids at tables together?
Yes. It's a matter of what environment a person can concentrate best in.
Mm-hmm. Allison Aria from the New York Times, what do you make of Liza's comment?
Well, it's very interesting, Liza, because much of education design right now is drawing a lot from workplace environments. The whole collaborative nature of work is very much influencing the way classrooms are designed and laid out. And exactly what you're saying is right, is that flexibility is key. And this can be as specific at this point as setting up tables and chairs within hallways so that the sort of chance encounters that you talk about can take place. The most numerous options that a workplace can offer are best. But I would also add to that that beyond the physical spaces, what we're seeing a lot of changes in is sort of the programming and amenities that are offered. There's a design consultancy I know in town that offers a Take Your Baby to Work program that all parents in the office sort of sign this pledge. And it's not a replacement for daycare, but you can take your baby up to 9 months, I think, if, you know, the babysitter fell through or something else, and they can just be with you by your desk. And then another parent will step in if you have a meeting or something like that. Employees need not just physical spaces of variety, but also programming and amenities of variety. And that will really help you retain your employee and result in a much happier workplace when all the vagaries of life are accounted for within the workspace.
Hey Liza, thanks for that comment. Appreciate it.
Joshua, can I just break in for 1 second?
Sure, go ahead, Professor Becker.
Again, I agree with both of those comments. What I've called what Liza's talking about is the cafeteria-style office.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally that. It's just like a cafeteria, is that you don't have to eat cherry pie or you don't have to eat apple pie. You get to choose. And what really good organizations do is they pay attention to what people choose, and then they can create the menu, if you will, in this case of spaces, that fits the range of kinds of people, work processes, and so on, that company has to accommodate. So that's what a cafeteria-style office is, literally that kind of choice process.
We're coming up on a break shortly, and we're going to get to some more calls. The switchboard has lit up. Rob in San Jose, stand by. I'm coming to you as soon as we get back from the break. But before we go to break, I just wanted to ask you, Professor Becker, and I know what Liza's talking about. My mom is a classroom teacher, and she works in a high school media center where everything is modular. The tables move, the computers move, it's all laptops. There's just really no main floor design. Very briefly, Professor, can you talk to us about what some of those metrics are? You said there's not a lot of research that says that one design works in a particular way. How would we measure what kinds of designs work? Very briefly, because we're almost up to a break. How do you quantify what works?
Okay. It depends upon the industry, but just as an example, that if you were working in a financial industry or a client service industry, it might be billable hours in a consultancy kind of firm. It might be sales if you're talking about Hewlett-Packard selling computers. It might be the number of patents and the number of new discoveries in a pharmaceutical company. There's lots of different things that you could look at to measure productivity. What we've been talking about isn't measuring productivity. We've been talking about measuring satisfaction. They're different.
Gotcha. That's Professor Frank Becker of Cornell University. We're also here with Allison Arieff of the New York Times, and we're going to get on with you as well, Rob in San Jose, who says the office process of transitioning to an open plan sucks. We're going to find out why after the break. We'd also like to hear more from you, 866-733-6786 or forum at kqed.org. Does where you work help you work? I'm Joshua Johnson, working in a very warm, well-lit, comfortable studio at KQED Public Radio. This is Forum. Stand by, please. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing the workplace, how where you work affects how you work, with Allison Arieff of the New York Times, Professor Frank Becker of Cornell University, and now on the phone, as promised, Rob in San Jose, who has been suffering through transitioning from an office to an open workplace. Good morning, Rob.
Hi, how are you, everybody? What I was saying was that the people that I know who have gone through an office transition, right, to an open workspace, some people say, they still pay me every other week, and that's really what I like. and some people have said, well, yeah, and there have been lots of people who say, I hate it, but, you know, it's not my decision. I know a lot of people who decided to work from home a lot more.
Uh-huh.
For those people that can work from home, who like to work from home, whose workspace is work jobs allow them to work from home, fine. I hate to work from home. It's way too distracting. There's all this stuff that I had to do. So I like to go to the office. I like that transition of getting to the office and going to work.
And being kind of away from all the distractions of day-to-day life.
Yeah, that's right.
So you would prefer, I'm guessing you would prefer, like, well, correct me if I'm wrong, an enclosed office where you can work, or would a cube do the trick? Or what would be your ideal workspace for you?
A cube does the trick. And here's the thing. I think that the primary benefit to open workspace is greater utilization, right? It's denser. You spend less money as a company on office space.
Right.
Fine, tell me that. Tell me that, like, in order to meet our quarterly numbers, right, we need to reduce costs. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to reduce real estate expense by 20% by moving to open office.
Right. Rob, let me put that point to Professor Becker, actually. We got to move on to other calls, but I appreciate it, Rob. Thanks very much. Professor Becker, in relation to what Rob said, psychologically, you know, some people just can't take, you know, being in one kind of workplace or another. Is there a way to measure that? You said there was no real metric for happiness, but how do you measure just employee comfort in a workplace?
Well, you can measure that. I want to come back to the point that he just made about telling the truth, because it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Is that his point was that if they just told me what was really going on, I could probably live with it. But what we've also found, again, we did 2 years of research on what we call workplace change management, and what we found that people hated was when they were not told the real reason for why something was going to happen. So we studied a government agency in Washington, D.C., and they moved them from the center of town out to the suburbs, and the rationale given was that you're going to have better ergonomics. We're going to have, you know, more comfortable, adjustable chairs, lights, tables, and so on, and that's good for your health. When every employee there realized the difference was $55 a square foot versus $29 a square foot.
Huh.
And what I always say is, I don't know of any company that deliberately tries to hire stupid people, you know? So people
figure. Would you like a list? Because I've got a few. I'm sorry. That was me. Go ahead.
So people figure it out. And I think that point is really important, that a lot of times if companies would just explain the real reasons, the business reasons that they're doing it, and then help people say, how can we help you work most effectively in this new environment, which we're going to go for? And can you perhaps even help us shape this new environment in a way that works for you? So we're not going to ask you whether you want to live in $55 a square foot or $25 a square foot.
Right.
But we can ask you, how could you live better in that $25 a square foot? That's part of the change process that often is lost.
You know, since we bring that up, let's talk to an employer now who is seeking some advice on the workspace. Al in San Francisco, good morning.
Hi.
What's on your mind, Al?
Well, my practice is growing very, very quickly, and I actually don't have space for all the people that I'm hiring. And I've now acquired the office next door to mine. We're about to put a door so we can expand into that, but I'm trying to figure out, how can I make the whole office environment flow well? How can I figure out what's best for the employees and workflow?
Let me put that to Allison Aria from the New York Times. Allison, I'm wondering what you've seen in workplaces as it relates to growing, expanding, changing companies, and how they manage for growth and also manage for quality. Because you don't want to grow into a new space. I mean, I've worked for companies where they moved from a tightly, you know, where we're all packed in like sardines, but the work was amazing. And then they moved to these gorgeous new digs, and immediately the shop just tanked. And it's not necessarily the workspace's fault, but how do employers deal with growing, changing workforces physically?
Well, that's a very complex question, but I'm assuming you have a smaller company. I guess I would just say, I was a founding employee of Dwell Magazine, and when we started in 2000, we had literally fold-up tables and one internet cord shared among 10 employees, and we were happy as clams. And as we grew, you know, the space got bigger, it got better. We had open space, we had closed space, but ultimately, I think is the autonomy of the employees and their ability to work in ways that are best for them that's most important. Because you're not talking about a build out for 3,000 to 6,000 employees like one of these other companies, I would start with the most flexible arrangement as possible. Go to IKEA and buy a bunch of, you know, of desks that people can move around and give them the option to work in the way that's best suited to them. Because the saddest thing that can happen is a place that goes from two crowded quarters and then takes up way too much space, buys too much equipment, mm-hmm. and then a year later you find like piles of air on chairs and discarded phone lines, which I've seen plenty of over the last couple of years, and I think there's perhaps nothing more depressing than seeing that scenario.
Or just furniture that starts disappearing. Oh, we don't need this chair, so I'll just move this in the living room. Al, best of luck to you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's speak now to someone who also knows something about the way that workplaces are reorganizing now. Jeremy Neuner is with NextSpace. It's a company that offers firms a unique way of working in kind of a – it's called co-working, I believe. Is that right, Jeremy? Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Joshua. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being with us. What is NextSpace?
So we talk about NextSpace as the workplace for the new economy, and we provide a unique combination, we think, of infrastructure as well as collaborative community that people in the new 21st century economy need to be successful.
And how does that work? When you talk about that innovative space, what would that be like?
We have a combination of different kinds of space. I'm really intrigued by some of the things that have been said previously on the program. We understand that people are both collaborative and community-oriented, but that they're also territorial, and that their needs change in terms of how they're working day-to-day, minute-to-minute sometimes, where they need to be open and collaborative, and they need to be sort of quieter, heads down. And we try to provide a combination of open space as well as quieter, out-of-the-way space, whether that is an actual office or whether that's just sort of an out-of-the-way nook or cranny in our open space where people can kind of retreat. And you'll see people all day long in NextSpace ebbing and flowing between and among these spaces as their work needs change.
So basically you offer kind of a standard workspace with all different kinds of spaces within it that people can buy into, rent, you know, membership to NextSpace, and then use those spaces as they see fit. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we find people as their businesses grow and change, similar to the previous caller, where they will scale up and down our membership ladder, where maybe they just need the open collaborative space, and they need more dedicated space, so they move into one of our offices, and then maybe their team downsizes again, and they move back into the collaborative open space. So one of the things that we try really hard to provide is that flexibility that people need.
Is this the kind of thing that you see mostly with certain kinds of companies that are open to using a co-working environment, or is it really a little bit of every kind of company? Who are your primary customers?
So certainly being here in the Bay Area, three of our four locations are here in the Bay Area. We certainly lean tech heavy in terms of the sorts of people who are, and the kinds of companies that are here at NextSpace. But one of the things that we're seeing, which we think kind of, you know, speaks to the overall trend of how the workplace is evolving, is that we see lots of people from lots of different kinds of industries. I mean, certainly tech folks, but also accountants and lawyers and graphic designers. We even have a sex therapist who's a member at NextSpace. So one of the things that we are really proud of is the breadth and the depth of the people that we've managed to attract to NextSpace.
Gotcha. Jeremy Neuner of NextSpace. I really appreciate your time, sir. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
Allison Arieff of the New York Times. Co-working, is that kind of the future of the workplace? What have you seen in terms of companies that co-work? I don't think Facebook would care to co-work.
Facebook wouldn't care to co-work, but
right,
lots of smaller tech companies would, in addition to the sort of co-working spaces of which there are many,
right,
especially in places like San Francisco and New York. There's something called Loose Cubes, which is sort of the Airbnb for workspaces, where the caller who said he hates to work at home, that he needs the regulation of an office, he could log on to Loose Cubes, and there are hundreds of companies on Loose Cubes who might have a cube that day. They might have one you could rent for the month. They might just like to have more people in their office, so you could go work in their office for free for a day.
So it's like a rent-a-cube?
It's like a rent-a-cube.
Wow.
And they have taken off, and they have offices. I won't remember the stats, but globally now, at least 100, and are growing quickly. And I think that there's, with the freelance economy that now exists today, it's sort of the perfect model to respond to that. Co-working, for similar reasons, a place like Hub Soma down at the Chronicle building, mm-hmm. At Fifth and Mission is similar. It draws a like-minded group of workers who are interested in tech and social change. And the idea is that while they're having a cup of coffee, maybe they'll have the next startup because of their serendipitous encounter. One thing I just do want to point out in this discussion is that we're really focusing just on the knowledge economy. And I actually did a little research project for an article once to see if many improvements were happening for, say, a Walmart employee or right. a shoe salesman. And it's kind of staggering how little thought is given to the state of those workers.
Blue-collar workers.
Blue-collar, right. There's no sort of social scientists or designers that or not enough who are kind of saying, how can I make a day better for the postal worker?
Professor Becker, before we go to our next call, do you know anything about that? I was thinking about this as we were preparing the show. I was thinking, I know this is going to be tech-heavy. I know it's going to be all about Facebook and Apple. Is there any research about using what we've learned in the tech sector or in the newest workplaces of the world to benefit people who just work a day jobs, you know, the blue collar workers, the people who go to work in boots and dirty jeans who also need a comfortable place to work?
Yeah, it's a very good point and a very good question. And it goes back to my earlier comment, which is there's just not a lot of really solid research looking at some of the implications of these different kinds of approaches. All there's lots of anecdotes and stories. I would say that when there is attention paid into these more sort of, if you will, they're often they may be knowledge workers, but they're not people at the highest end of that area. That often then what people are paying attention to is human factors and ergonomics. In other words, repetitive injuries to from carpal tunnel syndrome, so that it has an implication for workman's compensation,
right.
and so on. They're not doing it for the employees' pleasure and satisfaction. Again, as they are. As much doing it for a way of controlling cost and keeping people healthy, so they're not losing time.
If we could give you the $1 million research grant, what would you want to look into if you were able to just dig in any one of these questions? What would be your first question?
Well, for me, one of the first questions I have, and it goes back to the earlier point, is that what kind of workplaces work for people at what stage of their career? So that, for example, when you talk about what works at FaceTime and Facebook, when the average age is whatever, 27 or 26, versus maybe an insurance company when it's 45, versus some other areas, I don't think we've paid enough attention to how our workplaces can accommodate people over changing life and work cycle. If you look at the demographics of this country, is that that's going to be a very important kind of issue. And so it goes back to the range of types of space that we would provide people depending upon not just the kind of work they're doing but the stage in their life cycle.
Right.
So a 22-year-old may love coming to work just because it's the most social, fun, buzz kind of thing they can do. A person who's 45 may like working at home a little bit more. And when you're 55, you may want to come back to work at the office because you want that social contact.
Yeah.
So I don't think we know much about that.
The aging workforce is definitely going to have an impact. You're listening to Professor Frank Becker of Cornell University, Allison Arieff of the New York Times, and I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the workplace of the future and of today, how where you work impacts how you work. We've got a bunch of people waiting on the phone and a lot of great emails. Let me read through a few of them before we continue going, and then I promise we'll go to the phones. Starting with Michael in San Francisco, get ready. I'm coming to you in just a second. Devin writes, I'd like to mention my favorite workspace. I use a stationary bike with a desktop on the handlebars to work on my laptop on a daily basis. I always feel much more invigorated after an hour of light spinning while working. I think if I was doing that for an hour, for me, the room would be spinning, but I'm glad that works for you. Marty writes, after 40-plus years of working in Silicon Valley, the only thing worse than having a cube is not having a cube. Well said. Lucia writes, I worked in an investment management company with superb working conditions. One of the most endearing elements was a live plant per working space. Management invested in plant-caring people to maintain them weekly. Attention to the human aesthetic qualities of the environment shows care for employees and elicits productivity. very interesting. Now, Michael, in San Francisco, you say the 90s are coming back to haunt us? Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering, I don't know if they're not coming back to haunt us, but yeah, how do you portray today?
Hey, Michael, say that one more time. Your connection's not too good. Repeat
sure.
that.
Yeah, in the 90s, I worked for Shiat Day Advertising, and we had a virtual office where nobody had a desk, their own desk, nobody had their own computer, nobody had their own telephone. It was all shared space, but also shared resources. And, you know, for the most part, people sort of got along. 20% of people really did very well in this environment. 20 people would wash out after about a month. I'm wondering if, I mean, it had a lot of buzz in the 90s, and I'm wondering if the whole concept of the virtual office, were there any lessons that we learned from that whole experience that sort of come around in office design today?
Professor Becker, do you know anything about that, the virtual office? Shiat Day, the advertising agency, apparently that worked for them at least to some level. What about for other kinds of businesses?
Yeah, actually, we actually spent some time with Shiat Day in Los Angeles at one point in time. I think the point goes back to earlier points, which is that, you know, one solution for everybody in the firm and a solution that is so radical is not likely to work long time. And I think that's the lesson that comes out of this, which is that trying to shoehorn everybody into the same way of working, even in the same industry, even in the same firm, typically doesn't work. The flip side of that, however, is that we need to make a distinction between preferences and effectiveness. Preferences is, you know, what do I personally like, or what even I personally feel that I can do the best work around, versus maybe what works for the whole team, or what works for the department, or what works best for the firm. And that's something I think we haven't spent much time either, and it's a real tension. If I create something that works great for somehow the whole organization but doesn't work for key people, I'm in trouble.
Right.
If I create something that works for some individuals, but they feel productive, but they're not helping other people be productive, that undermines the firm. So I think there's this interesting tension that is something that needs to be much more carefully thought about, and that's, again, one of the places where this kind of cafeteria-style office with choice is a one way that you can begin to approach this tension between preferences and effectiveness.
Gotcha. Michael, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We did get a web comment from someone who apparently feels similarly to the way Michael feels. The commenter writes, "The opportunity to communicate and interact in an open environment is great, but it can sometimes be overwhelming, particularly when certain people who never stop talking are around. Headphones are a very important accessory at my work." Mine too. Another web commenter says, "I work at SFO, San Francisco International Airport, in an interior area where there are no windows nor natural light. My energy level decreases significantly as the day progresses at work, whereas on my days off, in natural light, I'm feeling charged up throughout the day, even though I am doing more physically taxing work." Let's speak to OSHA. Good morning, OSHA. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm the CEO of a newly formed architecture firm. We have a totally virtual firm. We don't have any office space at all, and we meet up at the kitchen table once a week on Friday to talk to each other, and it seems to be working really well.
So you really only see each other weekly?
Yeah, for a couple of hours. And part of the reason I did that is straight-up activism. I think that gender inequality is hugely reinforced by the fact that we tell people the way to get ahead is to be at your desk for 50 hours a week, rain or shine. And that doesn't work for people who are raising kids unless they have some kind of faithful stay-at-home wife, right? And that doesn't work for people with parents with who are aging and going through end-of-life processes. So I made a pretty firm stance about that.
So you did it for non-financial reasons. That's pretty interesting. How is that? I know you said the company is new. How new is it? Is it too new for you to know if it's working?
Yeah, it's only 4 months old. So we've had a lot of discussions about, like, will this continue to work forever? And to people's points about, like, not everything works for every other person, mm-hmm. we just said, you know, if at any point this stops working for you, please tell me, and we'll look into things like shared office space. And that seems to be on the horizon for us, maybe in the future. Like, if we get an intern who needs to be trained on a daily basis, then we'll have to have some more physical contact. So that'll be our next step.
I want Allison Arieff to chime in on this in a second, but I'm wondering, as the boss, how do you ensure workplace controls for your employees? I mean, part of the benefit of being all together in a room is that if I am the boss, I can kind of exert authority, influence, control, motivation. If something's going wrong, if a problem crops up quickly, I can jump in. I can hear the argument, go, hey, wait, what's going on? If you're virtual, then who knows what's going on? How do you mitigate for that?
Yeah, well, we use an application called Podio, which I highly recommend, and it's free, but it's like Facebook for your company. So we are always interacting on lots of different levels online. So I encourage people every single day to do updates on what their status is, what they're thinking about, what they're doing. So that's really unofficial. And then also on that website, we share official information, file sharing. We have group blogs for every single project. So that seems to be working. You know, and then we also do a lot of instant chatting, talking on the phone throughout the day kind of thing.
Wow. And it's Podio, P-O-D-I-O?
That's right.
Cool. Well, Osha, I wish you all the best in your new company. Thanks very much for the call.
No problem.
Allison Aria for the New York Times. What do you make of that? Just a totally an office that is no office.
I love that. I think that she's an architect, and there are actually myriad architecture firms who do that. One architect might live in Iceland, another might live in New York, and on a day-to-day basis, they don't need to see each other. You can share screens online. You can have WebEx conversations with clients. Overhead of an office is the major expense, you know, for a workplace. So I think that model totally makes sense. Your comment that you made about the employer being able to watch the employees, I think, is a telling one, because something we haven't quite got into yet is the importance of, well, I mean, I think it's been an undercurrent, but the importance of autonomy. That's what employees rank number one, is what they want out of a job. And an employer who feels as if they have to watch over their employees, that's already sort of setting a tone. If you're in a field like architecture where you've hired people for their talent and typical their individual motivation, that's not even going to cross your head that they're not working.
You can tell I've worked in some rough newsrooms, can't you? Am I telling too much about my career now?
But, you know, it's interesting to note that the new design for the Apple office is very much modeled after the Foucault's panopticon, whereas an unseen presence in the center can pan out. And even though there isn't someone watching every single office, the design definitely replicates that sort of constant observation and supervision.
That is something that I was hoping we could – I don't think we'll have time to get into it, but the design of the new Apple office in Cupertino, it's perfectly circular. It's this like enclosed, gorgeous glass circle, which is almost a metaphor for Apple. It's beautiful from the outside, but you cannot get in unless you have entrance. It's like this beautiful walled garden. I will I'll probably post a picture of it to Facebook, or at least a link for those of you who are interested, as Apple is pitching this new headquarters in Cupertino to bring everybody together under one roof. I'll post it to the Facebook page, so please keep an eye out for that. Let's talk now to Steve in San Jose, an office person who says he just needs privacy. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. It's not just a matter of privacy. It's a matter of some things related to individuality. In my most recent gig, I had my own office where I could shut the door. I could keep the room chilled cold, which was very good for me to be very effective in my work. Other people don't want to be at that temperature. I'm not very effective at when I'm overheated. I've worked in everything from, we'll say, food slinging at the burger place to in a dark room by myself doing spectroscopy, so I know the whole range. My worst experience was in a very open environment, in something called the Mobile Worker Initiative, where no one had a fixed seat. You kind of scrambled and fought for your chair every day, assuming that a regular chair would be comfortable enough and you didn't have back problems. I viewed it as a corporate attempt to introduce a communist mindset into an essentially capitalist environment at a large, very well-known Silicon Valley company that I won't be bad enough to name them.
Yes, but, thank you for not.
Where it was needed to do traditional communication, I'd never had a problem of walking out a door or having someone walk into my door when I was in cubicles. There was plenty of mode for communication. In a very open architecture, sound carries because you don't have the absorptive materials to keep sound from getting through. And so you have all this cacophony constantly going back and forth, no place to put your things, nothing to put even your own little reminders of here's how I use this thing, here's how I use that, to put them up on a wall in your cubicle to say, ah, here's my little tips and tricks cheat sheet to have there. So you have nothing to help you in your own individual way of doing things.
Well, I guess I can respect that. What is it with the cold workplace, by the way, since I have you on the phone? I'm from Florida. I do not understand why some people just need to be bone-chilling cold to get work done. I was born in 82 degrees. I like 82 degrees.
Well, that's
what is it about cold?
Well, some people like their environment colder than others. I really like a cold environment, and I get overheated badly. And some places it's nice to sit under, be positioned. Sometimes it helps to be right under the air conditioning vent where the people who like it warm can be positioned further away. And that just requires a little bit of flexibility in where an employer lets people sit.
Oh.
And that way you can have people accommodated for certain issues. Other times there are people who have allergies and they can't be under a vent.
Well,
and
Steve,
I'll
tell you what, Steve. No offense, but I'm glad you work in San Jose and I work in San Francisco because we would have a problem. But thank you for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. Let's talk to Eric in San Rafael. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. First, quickly, I got to say thank you for having a topic that relates to something I've been doing for 25 years.
You are so welcome, and I'm glad you called.
So in the 90s, someone brought up the trend there. And in the 90s, as a facilities manager, we spent most of our time transitioning from closed office to open office. And I think the new trend that I'm working on is from assigned seats to unassigned and building an environment that can accommodate the variety of work styles, as your professors mentioned, the cafeteria style, but we call them neighborhoods. So there's public neighborhoods, there's semi-private, there's private, there's collaborative, there's fun, there's serious.
So it's a workplace with its own zoning laws, basically. You've got all kinds of different workplaces.
Yeah, it is, and they're not necessarily set by laws. They're governed by the social contract of the workers involved.
That's pretty cool. Well, Eric, I appreciate the insight. Thanks very much. I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it at that. You are going to be the last voice on this hour. Eric from San Jose, I appreciate the call. Also appreciate Allison Arieff of the New York Times for talking to us about today's workplaces. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Professor Frank Becker of Cornell University. Professor, we appreciate the insights. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For those of you on Facebook, I did post the link to the information on the new Apple campus. You can find that on our Facebook page. We appreciate all of the insights that you have shared with us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. This hour produced by Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Mr. Danny Bringer. My name is Joshua Johnson. I'm here today for Michael Krasny. Tomorrow morning at 9, we'll talk about the fight over internet privacy. Tomorrow morning at 10, we'll talk about the future of Bay Area sports. I hope your calls and comments and listenership are in our future. Thanks for listening. Make it a good day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.